everyone, and welcome to episode 83 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you're a regular listener or someone who's read my work before, you've probably figured out that one of the things I'm really interested in is medieval medicine, how it worked in the past, and how it could work if you were in a situation where modern medical aids weren't available, like maybe a zombie apocalypse. Fortunately for us, I just happen to know an expert who can tell us a little bit more about the efficacy of medieval medicine and how it compares to modern medicine. Introducing Dr. Joe Alcock. Joe is an emergency physician, wilderness medicine expert, and professor at the University of New Mexico. When he's not saving lives, he's studying evolutionary biology, especially the microbiome of the human gut. As someone who's treated a lot of emergencies, Joe's invested in finding out what can be improvised to help people in tough situations, so we've had a lot of talks about how medieval wisdom might just come in handy. Here's our conversation on what typical medieval medicines really do work and why they work, and why it's just possible that there's more to treatments like bloodletting than we might think. Well, thank you, Joe, for joining me to talk about medicine today. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Danielle. I'm delighted to be here.
You are the first modern expert we've ever had on the podcast, so you're a very special person, and I'm happy to have you joining us.
All right. Well, that puts the pressure on, I suppose.
Now you thrive under pressure because you are not only an ER doctor, but you're a wilderness survival specialist. So we met talking about the zombie apocalypse 2 years ago, and we just did workshops this weekend on surviving the zombie apocalypse. So together we were talking a lot about medieval medicine and how you could come back to it if you needed to in the zombie apocalypse. So what do you think about the stuff we were talking about this weekend in terms of medieval medicine? Do you think, you know, some of it would actually work?
There's a lot of insights that we can take from medieval medicine. So yeah, so for your listeners, the two of us were both guests and sometimes hosts on the Zombie Apocalypse Medicine Meeting, which was an online event. 2 years ago, it was in person, as you mentioned. But this one is going to live on because most of the episodes were recorded on streaming platforms and are available on YouTube. I would, you know, advise people that are interested in that to check that out. Although I think the workshop that we did, the one that we're going to talk about today, might not have actually been recorded.
No, I don't think it was recorded. But we did have my go bag challenge where people could look at, you know, the stuff that I thought should be in your go bag in the zombie apocalypse. And you were Dr. Zed too, so people could listen to you giving advice about survival medicine, especially. Not necessarily medieval, but, you know, I think a lot of the same principles apply when you think about a world that doesn't have the same amount of drug manufacturing that we do today. So.
Right. So, yeah, I had the persona of Dr. Zed, which was a post-apocalyptic or post-industrial or pre-industrial physician during the zombie apocalypse. That was one of the persona that I had during that meeting. That's true. But in real life, I am an emergency physician, as you alluded to. I am an academic physician, and I work at the University of New Mexico, and I work at the University Hospital as well as a community hospital here in town. But to your point, I also teach wilderness medicine to medical students, and I've been doing that with some of my wilderness medicine colleagues here at the university since about the year 2000. So we have a lot of experience taking students out into the backcountry, teaching them various things. And I have to say, having done the workshop with you and reading some of the material that you have published, I've learned some things from medieval medicine.
Well, that's good to know. That's very flattering. And I didn't even pay you to say that.
It's true.
Now, one of the things that people talked about a lot of people put in their go bags, I don't think it necessarily came from my work, but the general acceptance of honey is a good thing to bring with you or to find or to salvage or whatever. So we know that people used honey back in the Middle Ages as a way to disinfect wounds, as a way to make medicine taste good when you had to take it and to bind it. What use is honey, do you think, that modern science has proved?
So yeah, when we think about evidence, and I am a big proponent of evidence-based medicine, and that is, you know, looking at scientific literature and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work. So that is something which I think probably does distinguish us from some of our medieval counterparts. but some of the things that were used in medieval times have been shown with randomized controlled trials to actually work. And honey is one of those things. So I agree with you. During our conversations and some of the comments we got from the participants in our workshop, honey was definitely something that people came back to over and over again and people were enthusiastic about it. So honey works for wounds and for wound dressings. It has a bunch of effects, and it is as good, possibly sometimes better, than some of our other kinds of wound and burn dressings that we use.
What is it that makes it useful, according to the literature that you've looked at so far?
Actually, before we get into that, what was the medieval conception of that? Why would people have thought of using honey back then?
I'm not sure why they would have thought of it. Like, who, the first person who thought about using it, I'm not sure what they were thinking so much as perhaps thinking that it is good to seal things together, right? It's sticky and it keeps things moist. And you can see that in adding it to food, right? It keeps things moist, it's sticky, binds things together. And I think, you know, if you have an open wound and you need to bind it, perhaps that was what they were thinking. We could bind it together with this. And the stickiness of it, perhaps they were thinking, because they didn't have germ theory, right? So they wouldn't have thought of it as being antibacterial, which we have now learned it kind of is.
It kind of is. So yeah, a lot of what we do in modern medicine and are definitely bringing into our modern conception of germ theory and the idea that we're always colonized and being confronted with dangerous microorganisms is when we have a part of our body which is exposed to those microorganisms and lacks its natural defenses, like intact skin, putting honey on that kind of provides a barrier. So it has that barrier function. And unlike, let's say, Vaseline, for instance, honey actually has antimicrobial properties. So it kills bacteria that come in contact with it. And part of that is just osmotic. So if you're a little bacterium and you land on honey or hard candy or something that has a super high sugar content, it will dehydrate that little bacterium and then kill it, or at least inactivate it. So it may not kill everything, but it kills a lot of bacteria and has that effect. If you think about it though, bees, when they go to flowers and they're collecting nectar, which then they add like salivary proteins and other kinds of things to make honey, they have an interest in making honey not be available to spoilage by bacteria and by fungi. And so they add little proteins to it. So honey also has some antibacterial and antifungal proteins that is embedded in the honey. So that's why some people actually recommend raw honey as opposed to pasteurized stuff you buy in the store.
I looked at some studies of it and they said you could use pasteurized stuff as well. It would still work. And that's kind of useful if there's a zombie apocalypse. But I do wonder if, you know, raw honey is better. And it's interesting because you're talking about bees having an investment in making sure the honey's not spoiling. And a lot of medieval medicine is based on observation. Now, I'm not sure if that was one of the things that they were thinking, oh, this honey's not spoiling in the wild. Maybe it's not growing fungus. But, you know, they may very well have observed that and thought about that.
They must have noticed that.
Yeah.
And just like how we can use salt to preserve foods, you can sugar foods also. Like, think about fruit that's been dehydrated and where sugar or honey's been added to it. That can last a long time too. I bet that didn't escape notice of our Middle Ages counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, I think they noticed that in that they didn't have to store it in a special way, but I'm not sure they were thinking of that in terms of medical stuff. Although maybe when I'm thinking in terms of putting it on a wound, but maybe when they were thinking of ingesting it, maybe they were thinking about that as being fairly clean. It's not growing anything, because they did use it a lot in the medicine that you're supposed to ingest as well.
So honey is a great example then of something that was used in the Middle Ages and something that has great evidence in trials and is actually used in medicine today. That's something which we can find use for. One of my colleagues, one of the co-presenters during the Zombie Apocalypse Medicine meeting, Clint Kalin, also found a review, the Cochrane Review, which is a well-respected group of folks that try to glean information from the medical literature. And they show that honey also works for cough. So that's something that I don't know if that was something done in the Middle Ages, but maybe it was. It certainly is kind of a folk wisdom idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's not something that I've come across, but yeah, it's been folk wisdom, as you say, forever. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's something that was known at the time as well. Now, you're talking about Clint. I did catch a bit of that Dr. Zed show with Clint talking about willow bark. So he was talking about willow bark being really useful. And that's something that people were using in medieval times to control their pain. So what are the studies showing about willow bark?
So we talked about that in the context of what do we do when we can't get drugs at the drugstore, if we can't go buy a bottle of aspirin. And people have suggested that maybe we could find a willow tree and chew on the bark and get access to the active ingredient in aspirin, that's salicylic acid. Of course, you actually find salicylic acid in lots of different drugs that you can find in the drugstore, but the primary one being aspirin. And just like aspirin, having some anti-inflammatory and some pain relief properties, there is good evidence that willow bark can do the same thing.
So
it actually works.
Yeah. And people are replicating this for aspirin. It's an artificial version of this, right? Acetylsalicylic acid, if I've said that properly.
I think you got it right.
Yeah. It's not nice my job. Not my first rodeo. I've had to talk about willow bark before. But I have to ask you, because I'm not a doctor, it's useful for pain relief. Is it useful for bringing fevers down as well? Is this one of those that is useful for both? You know, we give people aspirin when they have pain and fever. Does that salicin, the salicylic acid, bring down fever too?
So it is the medical word for that is antipyresis. And so a drug that brings down fever is an antipyretic. Just a fancy way of saying it blocks or prevents fever. So aspirin certainly does that. That's absolutely true. And, you know, other modern equivalent medicines like Tylenol or ibuprofen, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which includes aspirin, all these things also do reduce fever and have that effect. I have gone on record, and this brings in kind of a different domain of knowledge that I think might relate to this, which is that fever itself is something that we probably don't want to try to inhibit or block. Fever itself has some benefit. If you think about an organism, or think about a human living in the Middle Ages without access to antibiotics, you're kind of left to your body's own defenses against infection. So fever is actually one of those things. I don't think it was looked at that way back then. And even now, people are afraid of fever. That's called fever phobia. But getting back to your question, yes, the active ingredient in willow bark. You say it again.
Salicylic acid. Yep.
Acetylsalicylic acid has an antipyretic effect. It blocks fever. It also inhibits inflammation. So it will reduce, again, our modern conception of this is that it reduces the way that neutrophils and activated white blood cells, the infection-fighting cells in our body, that are also responsible for pus. And pus is something that would have been well known in medieval times.
Yeah.
It inhibits that too. So that inhibition of inflammation is good if you want to reduce pain and if you want to reduce swelling, but it might possibly reduce your ability to fight off infection. So that's something that we think about now when I'm wearing a different hat, which is applying evolutionary biology to medicine and thinking about evolutionary medicine.
Right. So we shouldn't overdo it on the aspirin because we might be taking down some of our body's natural processes a little bit.
Right. But you probably have to chew on a lot of willow bark to do that, to actually inhibit your own immune response.
Yeah, I would think so.
I think that if we are in a situation where we don't have access to modern medicine, knowing about willow bark and knowing about these properties, having something that actually can impact pain is going to be really useful to us because pain is a problem, right? And we need to have some way of treating it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think when people think about medieval medicine, they're always talking about amputation, right? How would you deal with this? And people really kind of think about this too much in terms of the Middle Ages, in terms of having amputation as a solution for everything, which it wasn't. But there are some cases where you do have to reduce people's pain. And one of the ways they did that was with willow bark. And one of the ways that they made people a little bit easier with treatments like surgery was by using alcohol. Alcohol is useful for a whole bunch of things. You and I were talking a little bit about Henry V's surgery, which is mentioned in the podcast that I did with Alana Krug, all about honey. But one of the things they used for Henry V's surgery when he had the arrow stuck in his face was red wine. And when you and I were talking about survival stuff, I was thinking in terms of red wine as being kind of a sterilizing agent in terms of the alcohol that you use. But you were coming up with other reasons why you might want to use red wine. So why would red wine be useful beyond just the fact that alcohol can be sterilizing and also a good way to make someone relax a bit?
Well, this is really, it's an area of kind of active interest, both in terms of public health and in medicine. There are a lot of people who believe that drinking red wine at a, you know, moderate level, say 1 to 2 drinks for, you know, it obviously varies based on your body size and if you're a man or a woman, but we'll say no more than, you know, the one or two drinks per day of red wine. There's some evidence that it helps your heart. So cardiologists, some of them recommend drinking red wine for that, as has a cardioprotective effect and protects you from getting heart attacks and that sort of thing. And then people have argued, well, if red wine's good, why not, you know, why not my Budweiser, my beer, or why not just drink a vodka tonic or something like that? What's special about red wine? And so when people have looked at this, there are ingredients in red wine that also have some of these anti-inflammatory properties. And one of them is resveratrol, which is a secondary plant compound, a phytochemical, it's a flavonoid that has these effects. So that molecule and many other like it that are in red wine, they also inhibit bacterial growth. So they have that effect. So not only does the alcohol have some of these anesthetic kinds of uses, like you allude to, but the alcohol itself inhibits bacterial growth, as does some of these secondary plant compounds that are in, you know, we find them in fruit juice too. It's not just red wine. They're in lots of different, like fruits, fruit juices, but also red wine too, more so than, say, vodka.
So it's better to have red wine in Henry's face than fruit juice or vodka. But it's kind of magic when you think about the physicians who are working on Henry's face. Like, he's the heir to the throne. Throwing in honey there and red wine is a great combination, killing all the bacteria as they try and dig this arrowhead out, which is actually really horrific.
Right.
Now, I had a question for you about, we were talking before about Avicenna suggesting the type of metal you should use for cautery. So we were talking about cautery a little bit. That is a way that people would close wounds in the Middle Ages. They used suturing as well with silk thread, but they also use cautery. And Avicenna is, you know, a great physician from back in the day. He says you should use gold for cautery. I did mention in our workshop that, you know, Avicenna also says you have to be careful not to heat up your cautering iron too much if you're trying to close a head wound because you might boil the brain. But anyway,
That's a good tip.
Yeah.
I would endorse that one. Don't boil the brain.
Yeah. He also says, like, be careful to filter your water so you don't swallow leeches. So a very smart guy. But he was saying that you should use gold implements when you're cautering because that's better. And one of the things that I didn't actually realize was how useful different metals are in treating injuries. So can you tell us a little bit about what metals actually are good when you're treating different wounds?
So one of the ones that we use frequently is silver. Like, silver preparations also inhibit the growth of harmful microbes and bacteria. So silver sulfadiazine is a preparation that we use on burns. And I know several researchers that have done a lot of work using silver nanoparticles, very tiny preparations of suspended silver that inhibit the growth of bacteria. So that's kind of cool. So gold, I imagine, does the same thing, but gold's more expensive than silver. So I think that's why a lot of the medical emphasis has been on silver rather than gold. But that may be a reason why gold would be prioritized back then. I can think of at least a couple other reasons why gold might be useful. Gold doesn't rust, right?
Oh, true.
Or tarnish particularly, right? So if like a oxidized metal would have little crevices that could contain bacteria and actually be a problem in and of itself. And maybe we'll get to this sooner or later, but iron can actually promote the growth of bacteria. So gold would be better than iron for those reasons. For
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And people were talking during the zombie apocalypse medicine meeting about copper being useful as well. Like, what is the use of copper when you're treating injuries?
Yeah. So there are copper preparations that are used again for burns or skin is missing for some reason. These metals, they inhibit bacterial growth. Some of them can actually kill bacteria. And I read something, and I haven't seen this recently, but there was interest in using copper preparations to even kill viruses like the one responsible for COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2.
Wow, that would be cool. Yeah, copper is something I think we will be able to find when our electronics die. We were talking about this in the workshop as well. People were talking about stripping wires and stuff to get at the metal underneath, which is useful. I don't think you could do cautery with copper because I think it would melt, but maybe gold would be easier to do that. Yeah, I do want to get back to the iron thing, because something that you and I had talked about that I had never really thought about before was that there might actually be something to bloodletting, perhaps. And I don't want people to start coming after you, but you're floating the idea that there could be something to bloodletting after all, and that might have to do with iron. So what are your thoughts on this?
So yeah, so bloodletting has been a popular therapy, not just in the Middle Ages, but certainly more recently. I think George Washington famously went through a bloodletting as part of the treatment for the disease that ultimately killed him. So I think one of the things about bloodletting is that I don't think it ever went away. When we think about modern medicine and we think about the things that we do, when I was a medical student, they told us, you know, it's both art and science. But I think some of that art and some of that learned knowledge and some of the cultural, you could call it cultural baggage or cultural inertia that goes along with medicine has really continued up until modern times. So one of the first things that happens to a patient when they appear in the emergency room, if they look sick at all, we're going to send a technician in to draw their blood, right? So we insert a little, you know, not a lancet, but we insert an 18-gauge angiocath needle introducer, and we remove several mLs of blood from them, maybe less than would have been done in the Middle Ages. But sometimes, like, especially if we do multiple blood draws, it can end up being a lot. So this is something that really happens.
It feels like a lot.
Right. Yeah. And then it's not totally benign either, because some people will have a reaction in their autonomic nervous system and have a fainting episode. So when you're passing out the side of blood, it's a very real thing. And that happens to patients, and it can happen to observers at the same time. So it's not totally benign, even if we ignore, you know, the problem of anemia, which is when you don't have enough red blood cells. But I would argue that bloodletting never went away. I think we still do it.
Yeah. Yeah, people are taking blood for all sorts of reasons. I always assumed it was to test it and not just to, like, get rid of the evil humors. But yeah, people do draw blood.
I wonder. Yeah, I do wonder about that. You know, I do feel guilty because, like I said, this is kind of a matter of routine. And the nurse or the technician will go in and draw blood. And then they say, oh, we have blood waiting for you to put orders in. And I'll say, well, we don't actually need to do any blood tests. And then I'll feel guilty about it. You know, here we took blood. You know, which is a precious bodily fluid out of our patients. And that's another reference. And if we don't put it to good use, then that kind of is kind of a waste. But yeah, could there be something to bloodletting? Could it actually possibly be useful? And I think this gets back to iron. So hemoglobin, which is the oxygen carrying molecule in red blood cells, hemoglobin contains heme, and the main molecule in heme is iron. So it contains iron. And that's why when people have anemia, one of the things that we test people for is iron deficiency anemia. And you can get that from blood loss, chronic blood loss, or from a whole bunch of different kinds of chronic diseases will be characterized by this iron deficiency anemia. But anyway, point being, if we remove blood from people, we're also removing iron. Can we imagine that there's some usefulness to that? Well, maybe a solution to this is that we have this evolutionary competition that we've had with microorganisms, and some really bad ones, like the one that causes meningitis. And that's Neisseria meningitidis. It's a really kind of a horrific gram-negative bacterium. We are exposed to it, and many of us actually can carry this microbe on us, and occasionally it will cause a really, really serious infection and can kill you within a matter of hours. That microbe does its dirty work by stealing iron from you, and it gets it. If you have free iron in your blood, it will take that iron and it uses it to reproduce at a rapid rate. So I would say that your body sort of, I'm making air quotes here, your body sort of knows this, quote unquote. And so your body has evolved all sorts of countermeasures to this. You have proteins in your blood that try to keep the iron away from these bad bacteria. And Neisseria meningitidis is just one. Even E. coli. E. coli can cause all sorts of bad things, septicemia, necrotic soft tissue infections, organ infections like kidney infection. And those bacterial infections are dependent on iron. So we know that iron deficiency might possibly be protective when you're confronted with these microbes. And so maybe by bloodletting, again, this is pretty speculative here, by bloodletting, we are actually giving you, the patient, an advantage against these microbes. And just to kind of reinforce this, there's an evidence in malnourished populations that giving iron, like iron fortified bread, which is very common, can actually be counterproductive, and it can increase the risk of having gut infections, populations where supplementation of iron is taking place. And there's lots and lots of examples dating back to the 1970s of basic science researchers showing that iron, when or during the course of an infection, if it's given to a patient, it can be harmful. And this is one of these things where it's almost like we've forgotten that this is a thing. This is pretty well known since at least the 1970s. We've forgotten our recent history. So I guess we shouldn't be too surprised that we've forgotten more distant history.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because if they're testing this and they find too much iron is harmful in populations that are malnourished, that actually relates back to a lot of people throughout history who would have been malnourished, you know, or they would have been exposed to things like E. coli just through living day to day. We imagine that people were perhaps dirtier than they are now. And, you know, a lot of myths around dirt are not quite true about the Middle Ages. But when we think about just the fact that they don't have the same sterilizing techniques or habits that we have now, you know, you're exposed to things like E. coli, or malnourishment was a real thing up until recently in the Western world up until recently, but all over the place. So it is kind of an interesting theory that maybe taking some of the iron out could be useful, and doing that by bloodletting when you have no other option. You know, it's kind of a useful idea. I don't know. It's a cool theory. I like it.
we're going to put this definitely in the category of don't try this at home.
Don't try this at home. No, 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 no.
And don't take medical advice from a podcast.
I think that goes without saying, but I'm glad that you did say that, though. Yeah, don't take medical advice from this podcast. This is a history podcast. But I think it's useful to look at how some of the things that people use, we shouldn't just throw them out because they're old, you know?
Yeah. So I think so far we've got our honey as a treatment for a burn or a wound. We're going to put a big check mark and say, yes, that's supported by modern evidence. Bloodletting, at least we have a rationale for why it might work. And I don't think this has actually been tested in any sort of a, you know, a modern experimental way. You know what? I'll give you one example, though,
okay.
That where we may actually do this. There's a disease called hemochromatosis.
Okay.
Have you heard of that?
No.
So hemochromatosis is a inherited disease in which you lose an iron regulating protein. And so what it means is that your body basically stores way more iron than it should. And ultimately, it's fatal. It can actually kill you. But iron overload in hemochromatosis is a major risk factor for infectious disease for exactly the reasons that we're talking about. And guess how we treat hemochromatosis?
Bloodletting.
Basically, yeah. They call it phlebotomy. We do bloodletting. So there's a modern tie-in there for a certain disease.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Yeah, it's interesting for that kind of treatment. You would be actively drawing blood off and not applying leeches or something like that, right? Because we do know that people are applying leeches in modern medicine as well. But for this, you wouldn't be using leeches, right?
Yeah. Well, tell me more. Tell me more about the use of leeches back in the Middle Ages.
Well, back in the Middle Ages, you'd be using them in the same type of places where you'd be bloodletting from. So venesection, right? You'd find a spot where it would correspond to the disease you had. And this would be based on all sorts of factors. So not just visible symptoms, but also the horoscope and astrology, in addition to astronomy and things like that. But leeches would also get rid of excess blood if you had it in a place that was visible, right? So anytime you needed to drain off some blood, you could use a leech.
Sure. It's an easy little, you know, biological phlebotomist.
Yeah. But we're not using them for extreme treatments now, though. But people are using leeches in modern treatments, aren't they?
So yeah. So you can actually go to a medical supply company and you can order leeches. We have them probably in our hospital and they may be put to use right now. The main utility that I know that leeches are used for now is for when someone has undergone surgery and they have a blood supply to a part of the body which is kind of on the edge. And we're worried that if the blood supply fails, then we'll end up with the tissue dying. So for instance, if plastic surgeon trying to reconstruct an ear or a flap where you're worried about a blood supply. So in plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery, this is where it might come in. And the cool thing is that leeches produce a protein called hirudinin, and that protein causes the thinning of the blood. So it actually promotes increased blood flow, which is maybe the opposite of what it was used for back in the day, but it can actually keep some of these flaps or tissue wounds alive long enough for the body to heal. So that's what it's used for now, mostly.
Yeah. I don't know about people using leeches in order to promote blood flow, as in they realized that using a leech would create more blood flow, but they were using it as a way to draw blood from one area to another. And sometimes when they were doing bloodletting, they would pick a spot that was on the same side as something they were trying to treat, and sometimes on the opposite side, for kind of the reasons you're talking about, in order to draw the humors from one spot to another. So a leech is still kind of yeah, the humors. But I promise not to ask you about humors.
You can ask about them.
All right. I will
just don't
ask
have an answer.
Right. No, we don't need to get into the humors. I do want to ask you, though. So you often head over to Arizona and teach. And when I went to Arizona to talk about the zombie apocalypse, I told everyone, get your antibiotics because the bacterium that causes the Black Death, Yersinia pestis, is still in rodent populations around there and in other places in the States and other places across the world. So I was always telling people, you know, if I had a time machine, I would be bringing antibiotics with me because that would be something I'd be concerned about. So for you, if you had a time machine, you had to go back to the Middle Ages, what kind of stuff would you pack to bring with you as a physician, especially as an emergency and wilderness physician? What would you bring with you?
So we were joking earlier, and I'm holding up a roll of duct tape here. So this in your go bag challenge, I'm sure that we talked about this, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, for sure. Duct tape, yep.
Duct tape. A million uses. It has a bunch of medical uses, especially in wilderness medicine. You can use it to bind wounds, all sorts of things. But I joke. I think I totally agree with you. if you think about the drugs that are most commonly used, that have the most profound impact on people that come into the emergency room or who are hospitalized, those two categories probably are pain relievers. And we've talked a little bit about aspirin, but we could also talk about opioids and things like morphine or heroin or opium. So there's the pain relievers. We certainly use those a lot. They have some downsides, as you know. But the other class of drugs, which is powerful and has had a massive impact on how we treat patients, is antibiotics, where it can really change the course of a disease. You know, I think if we think about things that you could probably leave behind if you went back in time, I'm definitely going to bring my antibiotics. I'll definitely have my penicillin and some of my synthetic penicillin derivatives. Things I could probably leave behind would be allergy meds, because we know that probably their allergies were few and far between. Allergic diseases and autoimmune diseases are thought to be a modern problem. So you wouldn't need to bring what would otherwise be a life-saving drug now. If you have an anaphylactic reaction, like a powerful body-wide allergic reaction to, say, peanuts or some other thing that you are exposed to, injecting you with epinephrine can be life-saving. But we probably wouldn't encounter that back in the Middle Ages. But infection for sure. So I'm absolutely going to bring antibiotics with me.
Smart idea. Is there, again, we're not telling people how to treat things, you know, based on a podcast. Is there any way you could MacGyver that stuff? Because, I mean, people always talk about penicillin being based on bread mold, but you can't really MacGyver that stuff pretty easily, can you? Like, don't eat moldy bread hoping that it'll cure you, right?
Yeah, unless you had access to petri dishes and you could inoculate a plate with certain bacteria and then sprinkle different molds on them. And the problem with that is that even if you found something that you were pretty sure killed off nasty bacteria, you wouldn't be certain that it might not kill you too. And so that's modern drug development. They find things that are effective against the target. That's usually a bacterium or a fungus or a cancer cell. But we also want to make sure that it doesn't just knock you off too.
Yeah. You were talking about opium. That is one of the things that people used as a way to put people under when they needed them to sleep for things that were big, like surgery, things like that. But people also use nightshade, hemlock, things like that. But you wouldn't be just doing that off the cuff. Like, don't go out there and grab a handful of nightshade and eat it. Like, medieval apothecaries had to train for like 8 years to make sure that they had the dosage right. And they weren't allowed to sell certain drugs like arsenic, which were useful for some things. You couldn't sell that, you know, unless you were a licensed person to do it. So, you know, don't take advice from a podcast necessarily. Those things are useful, but the dosage has to be absolutely right.
That's right. And I bet some of the medieval pharmacists or
apothecaries,
apothecaries, they would be aware, at least intuitively, of this idea of a therapeutic window. So if you go to a certain dose, you'll have the effect that you want. And then if you exceed another dose, then you're going to kill your patient. So it sounds like they had this idea as part of their training. And that is something that we think about now.
Yeah. So you would have like someone like Avicenna was a trained doctor. And he talked about using opium, but you would get your drugs from an apothecary. So in the same way that we have like pharmacists who know their drugs even more than many doctors know their drugs, right? That double check to make sure that a dosage is right. The apothecaries.
Yeah. Shout out for our pharmacist. We rely on them so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, well, they know all the things that you need to know. And it was the same in the Middle Ages. That training period, that apprenticeship was probably longer than most apprenticeships in every other trade because it was essential, right?
And my guess is they probably had a sense also of the placebo effect. So a lot of times you can prescribe just about anything and it can produce a therapeutic effect. So I wonder if that was something that, even though it wasn't well known, and we're still kind of wrapping our heads around this placebo effect even now. But, you know, a lot of times giving a low dose of something would have a benefit, even if it doesn't actually have a biological effect.
Yeah, people were smart. So I think they probably did have an idea of the placebo effect. So yeah, as you say, it's very effective. But sometimes they would do things that I think had more to do with the placebo effect than anything else, where it would be like, you know, if you have something, and I think people were still doing this with smallpox and measles, you know, if you have smallpox, look at something red and that will help you, you know, and it was kind of to go with the disease, right? If you have a disease that makes you very flushed, you should look at something red, or charms or prayers. And I mean, there's people who are doing science on whether positive thinking and prayer works now. But I think they did have an idea of the placebo effect, even if they wouldn't have called it that.
Right.
So, did you have any final thoughts on medieval medicine, whether we should throw it out completely or keep it going?
Well, I think we've come up with some good examples of things that were used in ancient times that probably did have a good scientific basis for their use. Can you think of any practices that were common in the Middle Ages that probably don't work?
Well, you called me out 2 years ago because I had read something not too long before that about people using masked trousers, right? So to prevent people from going into shock, to make sure they had blood flow, the Mongols would cut open a yak and put people inside them, according to the article that I read, right?
Of course they did.
Keep the pressure. It's very Star Wars, you know? Yeah. And so I had come across this, and I mentioned it.
That would put pressure on the body?
Yes, I think
to keep
them warm and to keep the blood flowing, from what I understand. Now, this is a couple of years ago since I read this, and then you talked to me afterwards and said, no, we don't do that anymore. So, you know, forget that idea.
No, we very rarely put people in yaks. That's true.
You have a lot of yaks in New Mexico, right?
That's a high altitude place. It has a very similar kind of a, you know, feel to it as Mongolia. Sure. There's got to be some yaks. I haven't seen any. So, no, but you alluded to this thing called a masked trouser.
Yeah.
And so it's a military anti-shock trouser. And that was, if you had a horrific wound and you were bleeding to death, say in the Vietnam War or even later than that, they would put you in one of these devices. And think of it as when they put a little blood pressure cuff around your arm and pump up the pressure. This would be like a blood pressure cuff that would go over your entire lower body. So it would squeeze down and pump the remaining blood in towards your heart and your central circulation. So that makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, why wouldn't that work?
Sounds good. Yeah, right?
Yeah. Why wouldn't that be a fantastic thing to do? But work done much later than after the invention of this device. I think it's still a sort of recent medical history, but it predates my training. So we'll say sometime in the 90s, might have even been in the late 80s, researchers showed that, in fact, the military anti-shock trouser, while it does increase blood pressure, it does nothing for survival. People that are subjected to this don't actually survive any better. And part of the problem is if you've got a bunch of holes in your arteries and they're leaking blood everywhere, increasing the blood pressure might not be a good idea. All you do is you think about a garden hose where you crank up the pressure. If there's a hole in that garden hose, it's going to squirt out faster. So it can actually just cause people to lose blood faster.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah. So yaks are not the problem.
Putting a body inside a yak or an eviscerated horse might be useful, but probably not for that reason.
Yeah.
I'm not totally giving up on that idea.
That's your next grant application, right?
Yeah, we're gonna study this Mongolian yak therapy for sure.
Well, I mean, it would keep people warm, but maybe
that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're going to shock, you need to keep people warm who are going to shock. Don't you? Yes.
That's a mainstay of trauma, is keeping people warm for sure. Uncomfortably warm for the surgeon or the emergency physician who's attending to say a shooting victim or a stabbing victim. But yeah, blood doesn't clot when it gets cold. And that can be a problem if you're bleeding.
Ah, see, I think people...
So that would work.
Yeah, I mean, you keep people warm, especially if you're fighting and it's a cold day, you know, open up a yak.
And who doesn't want the warm embrace of a yak carcass, you know, when you're when you're feeling down?
It's like a warm yak hug.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Well, you tell me how that study goes.
All right. Yeah, I will propose that to the NIH and we'll get back to you.
I think we have bigger priorities now. Well, I want to thank you, Joe, for coming on the show and telling us all about medieval medicine and how it could possibly be useful both now and in a zombie apocalypse. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Danielle. I really appreciated spending this time with you.
Thanks. To find out more about Joe's work, you can follow him on Twitter at Joe Alcock MD. That's Joe, AlcockMD. I would also recommend checking out his episodes of the Dr. Zed Show, which you can find on YouTube. Just search for Channel Zed. Incidentally, you can also find my episode of the Go Bag Challenge in the same place. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, hey. So the big news for medievalists this week is that the International Congress on Medieval Studies will be going online next year as the big medieval conference held every year in Kalamazoo, Michigan. This year was canceled because of COVID, but they decided for next year that they're going to, they won't have it in person, but it's going to run online from May 10th to May 15th. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of goes out. Here at medievalist.net, we do have a session that we've kind of planned out. It's called like Podcasting in the Middle Ages. Shock, shock.
Yeah.
So, and we'll find out, hopefully we'll find out in the next few weeks what's happening with that. And if we can't see you in person, at least we will be able to see you there all online.
Yeah. And it's not just this podcast that's going to be featured, right? It's going to be a round table, or it's going to be a round table. So we have other podcasts too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We've got some of the, great little podcasters that do medieval studies. So hopefully, maybe, we can do this to kind of even expand it and see, because it seems like there's lots and lots of new podcasts going out about the Middle Ages. I was just on the History A podcast talking about Mongols. So, yeah. So I'm kind of, hopefully that'll be a really interesting session if it can be held. So we have news on that on the site. Plus, we have some more articles about things such as an attempt to smuggle medieval artifacts into the United Kingdom, and how the sea ice may have actually caused the Little Ice Age that started in the 14th century Europe.
Yeah, I caught that headline, but I haven't read that yet. I really want to read that one and find out what caused the Little Ice Age, because it's such an important event in medieval history. It changed the climate, and that's not a negligible thing.
Yeah. Environmental history is always a really interesting topic. So yeah, have a chance to read on that. And, we've got, it seems like a lot of news is coming out in the world of medieval studies. So we will try and keep you well informed.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. That's the place to go for medieval news, right?
Yep, thanks.
Thanks. Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your support. If you love the medieval world, our Patreon is the place to be, since we've got subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, a book club, and exclusive maps by Tina Ross. Without you, none of this would be possible, so thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from medicine to the latest news stories, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sapolsky, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, and The 5-Minute Medievalist Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.